From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, a new approach for dealing with overpopulation. It emphasizes women's health and women's rights instead of just focusing on disseminating birth control. We'll talk with Adrienne Germain, one of the U.S. delegates to the UN Conference on Population and Development to be held next month in Cairo. Also today, the poverty industry in America. We talk with journalist Mike Hudson about his investigation into pawn shops, rent-to-buy stores, and finance companies that make big profits by charging high prices to the poor. TV critic David Bianculli has a preview of ABC's My So-Called Life, and world music commentator Milo Miles has a CD shopping list for Sukus fans. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate is getting close to deciding the fate of the crime bill. Majority Leader George Mitchell has called a vote on a procedural challenge by Republicans. He's hoping some of them will have a change of heart at the last minute. If the GOP succeeds and blocks the measure, Mitchell says he'll call a recess until after Labor Day. The Senate won't be able to act on health care, as Mitchell had planned to do. Republicans and Democrats on the Senate Banking Committee want to know why three officials in the Whitewater investigation have been suspended. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The three employees at the Savings and Loan Cleanup Agency had been involved in an investigation of the Madison Savings and Loan, which is owned by the Clintons' Whitewater partner. One of the investigators, L. Jean Lewis, had argued that taxpayer-backed funds from Madison may have been diverted to Whitewater and that the Clintons may have been the beneficiaries of that illegal activity. It was Lewis who wrote the formal request to the Justice Department calling for a criminal investigation of Madison, but Lewis has also been involved in another controversy, the secret tape recording of a conversation with an RTC official in Washington. Last month, Lewis and two other investigators were put on leave with pay pending an investigation into allegations against them. But the RTC management never specified what those allegations were. Now, Democrat and Republican senators are demanding an explanation. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Pentagon says there's ample space to house up to 60,000 Cuban refugees at the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay. Cubans rescued in the Florida Straits are being taken to the base, which is back in Cuba. The Pentagon says nearly 5,500 Cubans are now there. They've joined some 14,000 Haitians. The Pentagon says it'll cost about $100,000 to start running the camps and another $20 million every month to keep them going. The baseball strike talks have broken down in New York. Baseball owners and players had met face-to-face for 2 days. Evan Weiner reports.
The baseball strike, now on its 14th day, will go on indefinitely. That despite the fact that owners and players sat down for the first time at the negotiating table. Federal mediator recommended that the talks be suspended, subject to call, after a day and a half of discussions. The major issue, the owner's insistence on a salary cap and the player's rejection of it, remains the major stumbling block. Philadelphia Phillies pitcher Curt Schilling sat in on the meetings.
It doesn't seem like we're going to play baseball.
Why do you get that thing?
Just because nothing. I mean, they're not interested in anything but salary cap or salary limit.
The federal mediators will stay in touch with both sides, but as of now, no new talks are scheduled. For National Public Radio, I'm Evan Weiner in New York.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 17.5 points to 3,829. Trading is heavy on volume of 278 million shares. In over-the-counter trading, the NASDAQ is up 2.5 points at 754. This is NPR. Both sides in the Indiana strike against General Motors say they've reached a tentative agreement to end the three-day-old walkout. Local members of the United Auto Workers Union had walked off the job over job security, health, and safety issues. The Anderson, Indiana plant manufactures bumpers and exterior lighting. GM had been forced to close 9 assembly plants in the U.S. and Canada that had run short on parts. No details of the agreement have been released. A Native American tribe is suing the state of Washington over the seizure of a truckload of slot machines. State agents took the truck on a road outside the tribe's reservation. Bill Radke of member station KUOW reports.
The Spokane tribe is using several of the slot machines at the casino on its reservation in eastern Washington. The state and the federal government say the machines are illegal, and they've asked a federal court to ban their use. But the court has said that until the case is decided, the tribe can keep operating the machines. Last week, the state tried another tack. Saying it has the right to police its roads, the state seized a truck carrying 55 slot machines on a highway outside the reservation. Now the tribe has responded by filing a federal civil rights suit against the state. The tribe wants the truck and the slot machines back. It's seeking an unspecified amount of damages, and the tribe's attorney says next week he'll ask for a federal injunction prohibiting the state from further interference with the tribe's gambling activities. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Radke reporting.
A magazine survey says the best college bargain for your money is the new college of the University of South Florida. Money magazine says the school gets the top honor for the second year in a row. Money says the Sarasota school combines the high standards of a private institution with the low cost of a state school. Floridians pay just over $2,000 yearly in tuition. Out-of-staters pay less than $8,000. Houston's Rice University placed second. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The problem of overpopulation has been with us for decades, but the approach to solving the problem is changing. In September, representatives from countries around the world will gather in Cairo for a UN conference on population and development. Under discussion will be a document that was drafted by the participating countries in April, which emphasizes empowering women, promoting gender equality, and improving women's health care. My guest, Adrienne Germain, is a member of the American delegation. She's the vice president of the International Women's Health Coalition in New York and served with the Ford Foundation for 14 years. She says that our approach to overpopulation has been stuck in the 1950s.
In 1950, the world asked itself, is there a problem? And the answer came back, for example, from India, which had already then a very large population and one that was growing very rapidly, that yes, there is a population problem. That was picked up later on, especially by ecologists, environmentalists, biological scientists, who argued in a framework that Malthus had used 100 years before, that in a finite world, with a rapidly growing population, we soon would be out of food, out of water, and out of other basic resources. By the 1950s and 60s, it was quite clear that population was growing rapidly, in fact, at an unprecedented rate. And the solution then was decided to be technology, that is, to distribute contraceptives to as many of the world's people, in particular women, as possible. So in the 60s and 70s, the emphasis of population programs, and indeed population policy itself, was equated with or said to be exactly equivalent to provision of family planning services. It was a very narrow construct focused on a technological solution. And the paradox of this, of course, is that we were dealing with the most intimate of human relationships, with decisions between two people, away from the eyes and the interference of their governments and even their communities. So what we've come to realize over the last several years, and the reason that the Cairo conference is so pathbreaking, is that there is not a technological fix to the question of rapid population growth.
When you say technological, you mean birth control, sterilization?
Yes. Basically, modern means of contraception, the pill, newer means such as Norplant, which is a hormonal method that's implanted under the woman's skin, the intrauterine device, all of those methods, which are generally available to women in this country, were said to be important for women in other countries as well.
What makes you so certain that this approach doesn't work?
It's not that it doesn't work. It doesn't have deep roots. And I would say there are two or three dimensions to that. First of all, the emphasis in the last 25 years of these programs has been on quantity. How many married women of reproductive age would actually accept an IUD or the pills or a sterilization? There was very little concern about the quality of the service they were offered, whether or not they would continue to use the contraceptive and use it effectively once they had it. While a base was laid, an infrastructure was set up to deliver family planning services, public education campaigns were developed, and so on, there still were real problems and problems that remain today with the quality of the service being offered. Very often, no choice between methods. If you're a woman in Bangladesh in those days, you might go to a clinic and find out that you had no choice except an IUD in the very early days of their program. Well, now an IUD, or intrauterine device, is not necessarily appropriate for many women. For example, a woman who's not yet had a child probably should not use an IUD. Similarly, a woman who is not absolutely certain that her partner has no other sexual relationships probably should not use an IUD because there's an association with infection and IUD use. So there are many women, in fact, who should not use that particular method. But when programs don't offer women a choice and they are desperate to avoid a pregnancy, then they may end up using a method that's not suited for them. And there are many, many examples of this, which I think the family planning field has become very well aware of. And what's important about the Cairo document is that governments have acknowledged in this draft that we must put at least as much effort into the quality of services as we put into the quantity.
The UN Conference on Population and Development will be held in Cairo. There have already been protests in Cairo where this conference has been denounced as an American and Zionist attempt to dominate the Islamic world. And there have been similar protests in other Islamic countries. What are those protests about?
Up until now, most countries which are considered to be Islamic have supported and family planning programs and even have provided those services to their citizens. There has always been some amount of debate among religious leaders and among various political activists in those countries as to whether or not those programs were appropriate. But what was important and what remains important about those programs and the convictions of those governments, who range all the way from Indonesia through over to Egypt, is a recognition that especially women must have access to family planning and basic health services. That if they don't, they are threatened with very severe health consequences and even death. So I think what we're seeing here is not a surprising debate within the religious communities, across religious groups, and between religious leaders and politicians that has gone on, you know, for decades and will no doubt continue into the future.
I'm sure one of the things that has been very controversial within the agenda for the UN Conference on Population and Development is the subject of abortion, whether abortion should be seen as a legitimate procedure for birth control and population control. The Roman Catholic Church opposes some of the agenda for this conference because of abortion.
Here again, I think what is important to recognize is that somewhere around 180 government delegations will meet in Cairo to debate the final content of this document. There is tremendous diversity across those countries in the laws that restrict abortion or allow it, in the services that are actually provided or absent. We are reaching in Cairo for a language and a framework which will be respectful of that diversity, but as important, will respect and understand and be based on the reality of women's lives. Around the world, annually, there are about 40 to 60 million abortions. There are probably as many as 200,000 deaths due to botched abortion. That means that while we're sitting here having this interview, in 1 hour, 25 to 30 women have died because they did not have access to safe abortion services. Now, that is the reality of women's lives. Probably 10 times that number, 2 million, will be left either infertile or with severe health consequences, chronic pain, for example, due to botched abortions. That's the reality that we're trying to come to grips with here. In the process leading up to the final conference in Cairo, governments did a review language in the document which recognizes that unsafe botched abortions are a major public health problem that need to be addressed by every country.
Does the Cairo document have anything else to say about abortion?
It is dealt with throughout the document, really primarily in one chapter, which is concerned with health. It is raised in a chapter which is specifically focused on reproductive health. Contrary to some reports in the public media, abortion is not promoted as a human right by this document, nor is it promoted as a method of family planning, but rather it is recognized as a health issue. It is recognized that we must do everything we can to ensure that women have access to contraception so that they can avoid unwanted pregnancies. But it is also recognized that contraceptives are not perfect, and sometimes people are not able to use contraceptives, and therefore there will always be some number of unwanted pregnancies.
My guest is Adrienne Germain. She's vice president of the International Women's Health Coalition in New York. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Adrienne Germain, a U.S. delegate to the UN Conference on Population and Development that will be held next month in Cairo. From 1981 to 85, she oversaw Ford Foundation-funded projects in Bangladesh, including women's health clinics. Tell me a little bit about what you saw firsthand that made you think about what fails and what works.
Well, there is one really very striking example. And that is the difference between a typical local-level clinic that a government runs and the typical clinic run by a group that we've supported for some time, the Bangladesh Women's Health Coalition. Now, if you go to a government clinic, very often you will find it is not clean. There is no place to sit down, that is, for the patient or the client. There may be no medicines, or if there are, they're locked away in a cabinet, and the key is somehow not to be found. Too often, when women go to a clinic for service, they'll find that it's not open. By contrast, if you look at the Bangladesh Women's Health Coalition clinic, you will find that it is light and airy with all the windows open so the air can come through. There are clean white curtains in the windows. There is a bench where clients are invited to sit down when they arrive, which in Bangladesh is a sign of respect. If you don't invite someone to sit down, you're not treating a person with respect. So the whole, just the physical appearance of the Bangladesh clinic is very, very different from the government clinic or the typical government clinic. And yet, the Bangladesh Women's Health Coalition clinics are not based on high salaries, fancy equipment, fancy buildings, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, they deliberately have kept their salaries at the level of government workers. They don't have any fancy equipment. In fact, they do have to rely on referring clients with some complicated problems to a local hospital or government health facility. So we're not talking expense here. We're talking about attitudes. We're talking about how staff are supervised.
I believe you started the first study in Bangladesh of sexually transmitted diseases. So make a connection for me between what you learned in the study of sexually transmitted diseases and what your stand is now about the future of population control.
Well, one of the most important changes that needs to occur as we seek to transform family planning programs into reproductive health programs is precisely to include in the package screening and treatment as well as prevention for sexually transmitted diseases. There's a lot of resistance to this idea. It's believed to be complicated and expensive. I am convinced that it is neither complicated nor expensive. There are a number of investments that have to be made so that we can provide these services in very poor settings. We need better diagnostic techniques. We need better therapies and medicines that are easy to take. But what we mostly need is the political will to recognize that the world situation has changed. We have major HIV/AIDS epidemic. We have pandemics of syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia, some of which are already showing resisting to existing antibiotic treatments. We must do something to control the spread of these diseases in the general population. And so far, the AIDS control programs have been most importantly concerned with commercial sex workers, and more recently with their clients. But their clients go home to wives. And it's those wives that we're most concerned about, and whose only real access to services will be the Family Planning and Maternal Child Health Network. They will not go to STD clinics because those are highly stigmatized. I mean, there's, you know, and in any case, they don't really exist in any number in most countries. So we need one of the most central transformations of family planning is to include screening treatment for sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV. Well, another very important element here is for the family planning community to give much higher importance to condoms than they ever have in the past. Family planning community has never seen condoms to be a very effective means of contraception, and they've tended to be downplayed, therefore, in family planning services. But again, we must do much more to encourage condom use, to work with men, to take responsibility for their role in the transmission of disease as well as.
Well, how do you propose to do that? I mean, the emphasis on family planning, I think, has largely been on women, working with women to use birth control. How do you plan on getting to more men in the future?
One of the most remarkable things about this, I think, you know, finally, after 20 years of building up our strength, women's voices are being heard. And when they're heard in the corridors of the UN, it means it's men who's hearing them. Because like the parliaments, like the congresses around the world, it's primarily men who sit in those bodies. And the Cairo document has in it an entire section about men's responsibility. So we've made the first step already. Though that language is not contested in the document. We are not going to debate that in Cairo. That is already accepted. What we now have to do is change that language into reality. First of all, we can invest more than we have so far done in vasectomy programs. We can work with couples so that when they decide that sterilization is the choice that they want to make, that they give at least equal consideration to vasectomy as compared to tubal ligation. Vasectomy is safer, cheaper, and simpler than tubal ligation for women, and there's no reason that we can't right the current imbalance. Currently, tubal ligations around the world are 3 to 4 times as many as vasectomies. We can ensure that those programs that do provide vasectomy work with the men to encourage them to continue to use condoms even though they have been sterilized if they have partners other than their wives. And the reason for that is to prevent sexually transmitted diseases. We can invest in contraceptive research to develop more choices for men. Right now, they have, in terms of technology, only 2 choices, vasectomy and condoms.
You're one of the international women's health activists who is now going to head to Cairo for this UN conference. Is it something new that women's health activists are represented at the UN on this issue of population control?
Yes, it is something new. It's brand new. The previous 2 conferences really did not have involvement of women's health advocates. We did it by mobilizing at the grassroots in all of our own countries, putting together political strategies, pressurizing our own governments. We found people who could tell us how the UN system worked. We went to donor agencies and raised money to pay for airfares. And we helped each other to build solidarity across our diverse views and experiences, to get to New York into the halls of the UN and to be present as governments debated this issue.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. I enjoyed it.
Adrienne Germain is a U.S. delegate to the UN Conference on Population and Development, which will be held next month in Cairo. Tonight, ABC unveils the first official new show of the fall season, My So-Called Life, a family drama by the producers of 30-something. It's about life from the point of view of a 15-year-old girl, played by newcomer Claire Danes. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
First of all, it's a relief to see a show about a high school kid that actually stars a high school kid. Claire Danes, like her character of Angela Chase, is 15 years old and looks it. But most of all, watching My So-Called Life is a relief because it's so terrific and on so many different levels. The moodiness and whininess and self-absorption that always drove me crazy on 30-something makes perfect sense here, because when you're talking moody and whiny and self-absorbed, you're talking teenager. The writers and producers of My So-Called Life have captured teen angst and teen perspectives perfectly, even in the narration Claire provides as Angela. At the dinner table, her inner thoughts sometimes contain odd little asides.
I cannot bring myself to eat a well-balanced meal in front of my mother. It just means too much to her. I mean, if you stop to think about, like, chewing, what it really is, how people just do it, like, in public.
And sometimes her narration reveals surprisingly deep hostilities. In that same dinner table scene, her parents, played by Tom Irwin and Bess Armstrong, discuss Angela's newly dyed dark red hair. As they talk aloud, we hear Angela's private thoughts. And it's a good thing she keeps them private.
Oh, what am I supposed to say?
Nothing.
I mean, it's her hair.
Exactly. And we'll always be able to spot you in a crowd.
Lately, I can't even look at my mother without wanting to stab her repeatedly.
My So-Called Life picks up where the Wonder Years left off, but doesn't go for as many laughs. Instead, it goes for honesty. The writing, the acting, the staging, the camera work, all of them combine to throw you back in those long corridors where every person is a best friend or a worst enemy, every teacher is a major inspiration or a major bore, and every pimple, insult, and embarrassing moment is the worst thing in your entire life. Like this embarrassing moment, when Angela, daydreaming about a handsome boy in English class, is asked by the teacher to describe Anne Frank. To the amazement of everybody, Angela describes her as lucky, and the teacher challenges her.
Anne Frank perished in a concentration camp. Anne Frank is a tragic figure. How could Anne Frank be lucky?
I don't know. Because she was trapped in an attic for 3 years with this guy she really liked.
I've seen 4 advance episodes of My So-Called Life and love them all. There are no easy solutions, no pat characters. Best friends come and go. Valuable lessons aren't learned as quickly as you'd like. And conflicts stretch from one episode to another. Visually, many scenes are blended into one another through a series of fades and clever crosscuts, giving the flow and the show a certain dreamy quality. The music in the series is wonderful, the plots are believable, but they often surprise you. And if David Caruso was TV's Redhead of the Year last season, Claire Danes should get similar honors this season. She's wonderful, and her character doesn't always pout, whine, or screw up. At the end of one episode, attending a mother-daughter fashion show, she actually sounds content.
It's good to get really dressed up once in a while and admit the truth. That when you really look closely, people are so strange and so complicated that they're actually beautiful. Possibly even me.
My daughter, who just turned 12, watched all 4 of the My So-Called Life preview tapes before I did, and she loved them too. When a 40-year-old parent and a 12-year-old kid can watch the same family drama and get the same level of truth out of it, that's really something. My So-Called Life is really something.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, why the poor pay more. We talk with Mike Hudson about his investigation into the poverty industry, the finance companies, rent-to-own stores, and pawn shops that make big profits charging high prices to poor people who don't qualify for bank loans or credit cards. Also, world music critic Milo Miles has a few suggestions for your record store shopping list. He reviews new albums by Sukus bands from Zaire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate has started voting on a procedural matter that will determine if the controversial crime bill comes up for a vote. Senate Republican leader Bob Dole has all but conceded defeat on the procedural motion. He says if the crime bill passes, it's a certain victory for President Clinton, but it's loaded with wasteful spending and doesn't stem crime. The GOP has tried to block passage of the bill on these matters, but the Democrats charge the GOP is really interested in trying to strip the bill of its ban on 19 types of assault-style weapons. The Clinton administration is defending its new policy on dealing with Cuban refugees. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
The White House brought Undersecretary of State Peter Tarnoff out to again defend President Clinton's policy of turning away and detaining Cuban refugees and to declare that the policy deserves not criticism, but praise.
We're coping with it extraordinarily well. There are more than 70 U.S. vessels, the Naval and Coast Guard out there. And I think all of us in the administration, I hope the American people are proud of the way the United States has responded to this humanitarian situation involving these people who are, of course, at great risk leaving Cuba in the kinds of conditions you're aware of.
And Tarnoff once again rejected any suggestion of high-level dialogue between the U.S. and Cuban President Fidel Castro. Bill Small at the White House.
A federal judge has cleared the way for AT&T to acquire Macaw Cellular Communications. U.S. District Judge Harold Green has granted a waiver of a consent decree so AT&T can acquire the cellular phone properties in Houston and Los Angeles. Macaw co-owns these with several regional Bell phone companies. Green's action is the last major hurdle for the deal. The Justice Department has okayed the deal as long as AT&T follows rules intended to foster competition. Two people were killed this morning in an armored car hijacking in the southern New Hampshire town of Hudson. Lita Hartman of New Hampshire Public Radio has this report.
At about 9:30 this morning, three robbers dressed in masks and jumpsuits attacked an armored car outside the NFS Savings Bank in Hudson. Authorities say the robbers shot and killed two guards, put the bodies in the armored car, and then made their getaway. Senior Assistant Attorney General William Lyons.
Preliminary indications are the deaths are related to the apparent robbery of a Manchester security armored car. The deaths are being treated as homicides.
Police found the armored car a short time later. They're continuing to search by plane and by car for two other vehicles which may be carrying the suspects. Police sources say that because the operation was unusually well planned, it may have been carried out by out-of-state professional bank robbers. For National Public Radio, I'm Lita Hartman reporting.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost almost 17 points to end the day at 3,829. Declining issues led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Israeli army says the Israeli secret police recently detained a group of PLO activists suspected of killing alleged Palestinian collaborators. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The detainees are members of the Fetah Hawks group, affiliated with PLO leader Yasser Arafat's Fetah faction. The army said they're suspected of killing an Arab-Israeli policeman and nine Palestinians. The army would not say how many had been detained, but said other Fetah activists had evaded capture by fleeing to the Jericho area under Palestinian self-rule. A senior Israeli security official said Jericho is becoming a city of refuge and demanded that the PLO do more to find Palestinians accused of attacks on Israelis or suspected collaborators. The Fetah Hawks have been active mostly in Gaza, and many of them joined the Palestinian security forces when the self-rule agreement was implemented. Israel says Palestinians are violating that agreement by continuing to pursue collaborators. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A new Gallup poll finds that school violence and discipline are bigger worries for parents than education fundamentals. A Gallup poll of some 1,300 parents puts these problems at the top. They're followed closely by lack of money, drug abuse, and concerns about quality education. Most respondents say schools can't do much about the violence. They blame it on the prevalence of gangs, drug abuse, and weapons. Firefighters in Washington state expect to contain a giant, stubborn wildfire by tonight. Officials say the Tyee Creek blaze should be encircled. It's taken crews a hard-fought month to do this. A fire spokesman says full control isn't expected until the middle of next month. The fires burned more than 128,000 acres in the north-central part of Washington state. In Idaho, 6,400 firefighters are still on the line against a dozen fires. The Army is dispatching 500 more soldiers to one blaze that charred more than 57,000 acres in the southwest part of the state. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The people with the least money often pay the highest prices. Journalist Mike Hudson has been investigating what he calls the poverty industry, the stores and finance companies that make big money by targeting the most economically vulnerable people, the poor and working class, as well as middle-class consumers who are unemployed and overwhelmed by bills. Hudson's article, Robin the Hood, was published in the August edition of Mother Jones. He edited a section on the poverty industry for Southern Exposure magazine. He describes the companies which make up the poverty industry as the new loan sharks.
They're not new in the sense that they haven't been here, but we're talking about pawn shops, check cashing outlets, rent-to-own furniture and television stores, finance companies. These are businesses that in one form or another have been around for a long time. But the key is that now they're multiplying in number, and now they're often are owned or by Wall Street companies or traded on Wall Street. There are many chains. There are several national chains of pawn shops.
You say I want credit, and I've been turned down by banks. What is an example of a place that I could go to, but I'm going to end up paying a whole lot more interest?
Well, you could go to a pawn shop. You know, pawn loan works like this: you bring in some security, a television, whatever. Typically, they like jewelry because it's small and it can be stored easily. And so you've got a piece of jewelry worth a couple hundred dollars. They'll lend you $50, and then you come back the next month and if you want to get it back, you pay $60. That's a 20% interest rate from one month to the next, but if you figure that out, that's an APR, annual percentage rate, of 240%. So if you borrowed $100 for a year, you're going to have to pay back $340 to get your merchandise back. You know, the other types of loans are finance company loans, which typically run 30% or more. In some states, South Carolina, for example, they can run more than 100%.
So say you get turned down by a mainstream bank for credit and you end up at a finance company. What are you likely to find there?
You're likely to pay for a small loan of $4,000 or $5,000 or $400 or $500. You're likely to pay as much as 30 to 35% annual interest rate. They're likely to try and sell you, sometimes without your knowledge, a lot of credit insurance to increase the loan value.
Well, what problem do you have with the high interest rates if, after all, these finance companies are taking a big risk by loaning money to people who aren't a very safe risk?
Well, the prices that are charged, I think, often don't have that much to do with the degree of risk, but with the degree of desperation and the lack of financial sophistication of people. A lot of people don't understand, you know, about comparing annual percentage rates, or they just feel they don't have any choice. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with charging a little more to cover your risk for people who have less income or have poor credit histories, but when it gets to the point that the charges are piled on so high that people never get out of debt, that's when I think we have to to question that and look at that and look at how these businesses are operating.
Let's get to check cashing stores. If you don't have a checking account, you often end up at a check cashing store. How do they work and where do they make their profit?
Well, typically you'll come in and say you have a check for $500 and they'll just take a percentage fee off the top to cash the check. They may charge as much as 10%. So for a $500 check, you'll go in, they'll cash the check and give you $450 and keep 50 as their fee.
Now, they're taking a risk on giving you the money, right, because you don't have an account that will cover the check if the check bounces.
Right.
Does 2 to 10% seem like too much to ask for to cover that risk?
Well, they did a study in Chicago of public welfare checks, and you know the interest rates and they found that well under a fraction of 1% of all the checks bounced had been stolen. So typically, check cashing outlets make a much higher return on their equity than banks, for example.
Why do you think somebody would go to a check cashing store that charges a 2 to 10% percentage of the check when they could go to a bank, open up a checking account, and just pay a pretty small fee to keep the checking right. account going?
Part of it may be a transportation problem. There may not be a bank within 50 blocks, 20 blocks of their home. The check cashing outlet is on the corner. It's easy. Check cashing outlets often call themselves the 7-Elevens of banking, because they're quick and they're easy. And some people, banks will not open checking accounts for them if they don't have enough money to start out with the account. Some banks will check your credit history, and if you have some bad marks on your credit history, they won't open an account for you. And, of course, banks, minimum balance fees will add up. And a lot of people just don't look at it in the long term. If you're going to a check cashing outlet, you may pay $300 or $400, $500 a year just for the privilege of cashing your check. Whereas even with when the minimum balance fees at a bank are pretty high, they're not going to run more than $100, $200 a year.
Journalist Mike Hudson is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Mike Hudson. He's written about the poverty industry for Mother Jones, Southern Exposure Magazine, and Washington Monthly. Another institution that you put in the category of the poverty industry is the rent-to-buy stores. Tell me how they work.
Rent-to-owned stores typically pay $9.99 a week to buy a television. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it adds up.
You can rent it for $9.99 a week, and the money that you spend goes toward the
price. Goes towards ownership. And typically right. after a year or 18 months, you own it.
Mm-hmm.
The one good thing about it is if at any point during the transaction you decide you don't want it or you can't afford to pay anymore, you can bring it back without any further penalty. Unfortunately, though, you may have paid in for a television. You may have paid in for a $300 television. You may have paid $1,000. Over a year and lose your job or just run out of money and can't pay anymore, they're going to come get the television and you've lost all the money you've paid in. Typically, rent-to-own items are going to cost you about 3 to 4 times retail.
You trace these rent-to-own centers back to the 1960s, and you said they were designed to skirt certain laws that limited interest rates. What changed in the 60s that brought about this new kind of store?
A lot of state legislatures were passing laws to limit interest rates on retail credit stores charged by inner-city furniture and appliance dealers. There'd been a lot of activism in inner cities, kind of in tandem with the civil rights movement, to fight some of this price gouging. But soon after these laws went into effect, Some store owners got the idea of skirting the interest rate limits by putting the items out as rent-to-own. And by defining them as rent-to-own, in most states, they can get around any sort of limits on what they can charge.
Because it's not an interest fee, it's a rental rate.
Right. And, you know, there's some lawsuits over that question, but most state laws now define rent-to-own as a transaction that doesn't involve charging interest rates.
There have been a couple of class action suits in a couple of states against institutions that charge very high interest rates for money. What kinds of class action suits are starting to develop now?
A lot of the class action suits are accusing these companies of what's called reverse redlining. If redlining is where you won't lend money in these neighborhoods, then reverse lending is where you're lending money in these neighborhoods. You're targeting these neighborhoods for extremely high rates. Often, some of the community activists describe it as predatory lending. Fleet Financial Group, which is the largest bank in New England, earlier this year settled an attorney general's investigation and several class action lawsuits in Georgia for $115 million. The bank was accused of using its finance subsidiary to target 16,000 to 18,000 African-American borrowers for extremely high rates, and working with a lot of the shady 10 men and mortgage brokers.
Is there any proposed legislation to regulate the kind of institutions that you describe as the new loan sharks?
There's been some legislation on the state and federal level. A lot of the legislation has actually been written by the industries themselves in order to head off tighter regulation. The rent-to-own industry, for example, has been successful in getting an industry-written bill passed in about 30 states, which requires the industry to disclose things like the total price charged and whether the item is new or used, but it exempts rent-to-own transactions from state retail credit limits. There's federal legislation now that appears about to pass that will put some limits on high-interest mortgages in minority and low-income neighborhoods. One thing it does is it gives sort of a Surgeon General's warning for certain types of loans. There'll be a warning on there that basically says, you know, that this is a high-interest loan and you may be able to get a better interest rate elsewhere, and you may be in danger of losing your house if you cannot pay this.
What are some of the obstacles, if any, that you ran into in trying to research these institutions?
You know, one problem I had, it just took a lot of work to overcome, was getting consumers to talk about themselves and talk about their financial situations. It's hard, especially in America, where, you know, everyone is expected to have lots of money, and you watch television and, you know, the way to happiness is to buy more and own a great car. So, and a lot of people who are poor or sort of on the borderline of poverty, I think there's a sense of shame. So they're afraid to come forward if they've been scammed by, say, a mortgage company. They don't want to talk about it.
Mike Hudson is a reporter with the Roanoke Times and World News. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. The Cubans keep on coming. That news remains the same. I'll talk with NPR's John Burnett, who's been up in a small plane today flying over the Straits of Florida, almost all the way down to Cuba. Martha Raddatz reports on preparations at Guantanamo Bay. There could be a total of 60,000 refugees housed there, including the Haitians. In other news, I'll talk with Ken Aletta of The New Yorker about the resignation of Jeffrey Katzenberg at the Walt Disney Company. We'll have part three of our series on the state of California's economy. Also, letters from listeners about Japan and wildfire, and a jukebox recommendation.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For decades now, the most popular style of African music south of the Sahara has been soukous, the guitar-driven rumbas from Zaire. World music commentator Milo Miles says that after a couple of so-so years, soukous releases in the U.S. are booming. This is kind of a shopping list for those who already know a little about the music, so fans should get pencil and paper ready.
Although the future of Zaire itself looks rocky these days, the future of soukous is in good hands with newish bands like Wenga Musica. Their first album came out 6 years ago and has just been issued in this country. The title is Bougere Bougere, and it's a honey. In part, Wenga Musica are young neoclassicists, a bit like Wynton Marsalis in jazz. They have made tradition sound impetuous and fresh, and their playing keeps Latin elements from the early days of soukous. Moreover, they prefer melodies with more sway and fewer arrangements that plunge madly into guitar rave-ups. For those who complain all soukous sounds alike, Wenga Musica tunes have exceptional variety and spunk. You know, synthesizers that sound as homey as harmonicas. There is a French offshoot of the band called Wenga Musica du Paris. Avoid them. What you want is Wenga Musica's Bougere Bougere, or the equally sterling brand new one with the big jet on the cover called Kala Ye Boeing. In other soukous developments, Pablo Lubadica is a soukous session guitarist, much in demand. Now, I'm always nervous when session cats or band members come out with solo albums. After all, a certain degree of flashy personality and sense of presentation is what makes a star, and it's exactly what background folks often lack. This is not the case, however, with Lubadica. His melodies have delightful sweetness and arrangements graced with guitar solos like Dancing Crystal Chandeliers. And there's a humble, collective enthusiasm to his ensemble work. The title of Lubadica's solo album is a mouthful, Oko Mini Okolo, but don't worry, it's the only one around by him. Star quality is indeed the essential ingredient in the soukous singer with the unlikely stage name of Madelou System. His voice projects exceptional warmth on his solo album Sans Commentaire, though his skill at dramatizing characters is lost on those who do not speak Lingala. Soukous fans worth their salt will remember the hit Mario, which was a highlight of the late career of the great bandleader Franco. The key lead vocalist was Madelou System, and his pair of tributes to Franco, Yajan and Nezele, radiate dignity and warmth above and beyond any language blocks. Madelou System is someone you get friendly with right away. Nazangi sute na vinangae. Oh, abonnez les langues, yo.
mobali ya boyinga na se ya ndoto aloti nazweli embanda natongola mokiole atunanga akamati desizio.
There hasn't been a new Sukus anthology in quite a while, so those who like package deals should jump at the collection called Super Guitar Sukus. All current styles of Sukus are represented, and compiler Gerald Seligman has arranged for a very smooth flow from song to song, particularly in the first half. Because it draws on material only from the EMI label, Super Guitar Sukus is neither definitive nor an ideal introduction. But the collection should fascinate seasoned fans as well as newcomers because it includes a number of superlative though obscure performers, such as Dave DePeux. A final tip from insiders. Sukus is smooth and airy enough to keep you dancing through a whole CD, but wise steppers will follow the undulating bass or the drums, not the frantic guitar solo parts. Nobody wants to end up breathless after just one or two cuts. Now, go kwasa kwasa till the cows come home.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Jill Bracey and Kathy Wolf. Abby Beshkin is our intern. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, the music of New Orleans. We speak with songwriter and pianist Alan Toussaint, one of the important behind-the-scenes figures in early New Orleans rock and roll. And Vernell Bonarice plays the music of Jelly Roll Morton. He's performing his musical Jelly Roll off-Broadway. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.